DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Satellites gone up to the skies. Things like that drive me out of my mind.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. On the show, small satellites, big missions. We take a look at the fast-growing private nanosatellite industry.
First, I'm going to do is I'm going to brush your hair.
Noises that trigger head orgasms. What's the science behind it? And today's secret sound, any ideas? Does it make you irate, want to turn the radio off? Don't. I promise you we'll get to the bottom of it and why it's making you feel the way you do. All that and more on this jam-packed edition of Spectrum. If you like you're being watched, don't worry, you're not paranoid. You are being watched, we all are, and there's an ever-growing number of people doing it, observing us from space. A lot of Earth observation is done by the big space agencies, but increasingly, as the technology gets smaller and cheaper, businesses are also getting in on the act, and not only with still photography. The next big thing is video, and as Sulfur Karabani has been finding out, some of the industry's biggest innovators are in the UK.
Yes, yes, I know. If it's in space, it probably started in the United States. It's true for a lot of things. The Americans have, until now, been one of the main pioneers in space. And it's certainly true for Earth observation. Just think of the JSON or Landsat satellites. They've been doing it for years, longer than the Europeans anyway. But that's all changing. With Europe's Copernicus program and its family of Sentinel satellites, the balance of power is shifting in space. The Sentinel satellites monitor things like land coverage, agriculture, oceans and atmosphere, shipping routes. There's even a bit of people surveillance too, but we don't like to mention that too much. The point is, the Sentinel satellites deliver masses of data, loads of amazing still images, and, this being Europe, it's all open data, free of charge, which is great if you know what you're doing. And in the UK, a bunch of companies like BirdEye know exactly what they'd like to do with the data. Some, like EarthEye, another company, are even upping the game from still shots to video, and they want to do it themselves.
Yes, interesting. There are a number of players, most of them North American, that are creating what's now being called the new space sector.
That's Jonathan Sumner, Business Development Director at EarthEye, a UK company that hopes to launch a big constellation of its own satellites to deliver full-colour, high-resolution video of Earth. He says new space is about the commercialisation of low-cost satellite technology that's just about emerging.
Companies like of Planet and Black Sky and Earthcast are already out there pioneering this new market opportunity, which is exciting. In addition to that, and what's often overlooked, is the downstream players, the innovators who are taking that technology, that data, this stream of new high-quality Earth observation data, and feeding it into new analytical capabilities, platforms, algorithms and machine learning that are starting to do really interesting things with what we're calling planetary big data.
Yep, you heard right. Planetary big data. Just when you thought you were getting your head around or just plain getting over terrestrial big data, the space industry throws yet another new term at you. But let's park that for now, because this market still has to become a real thing. EarthEye is a startup of sorts. It's already doing business in analytics with space imagery, but video is, how shall I put it, sexier? Either way, EarthEye's Earth observation video concept would target commercial customers with fast turnaround images of objects up to about 1 meter in size. So you could see cars in a city, but you probably couldn't make out the number plates. You could, however, create 3D sweeps of a city. To achieve this, they want to exploit small satellite technology, and they're working with one of the UK's oldest pioneers in space, Surrey Satellite Technology Limited, or SSTL. The company's founder, Professor Sir Martin Sweeting, says there's a history to this small satellite revolution.
I mean, if you go back historically, when we started the first microsatellites in the 1980s, you know, this was considered something which was of very little use, possibly of some research interest, but no practical use. But as microelectronics and the techniques developed and they started to be able to be used for operational purposes, the small satellites became actually quite attractive, first to emerging space nations and then to business. And what we've seen over the last decade is that these small satellites now have really changed the whole way we look at space. And the UK essentially has pioneered that since about the early 80s. But now it's become fashionable, and almost everybody, you know, I lost count of how many nations, something like 65 countries are now using small satellites in one way or other to get more cost-effective access to space and access to space data. So it's become a fashion, but you know, the UK has really been a pioneer of this small satellite revolution.
It bears mentioning, though, that not all small satellites are born equal.
Small satellites sort of encompass actually quite a wide range of things. So what we can say is what they're not. They're not big satellites. And, you know, a lot of the conventional, traditional satellites have weighed well over a ton, or sometimes several, four, five, 6 tons. These are spacecraft which typically weigh under about 500 kilos. And they can be the size of a minivan, the size of a domestic fridge, or even the size of a loaf of bread. So they range from nanosatellites, the size of a loaf of bread, microsatellites, fridge size, mini satellites, like a small minivan.
There's a lot of work in the UK on small satellites. Twinkle, for instance, is a project that aims to use them to provide low-cost access to space for science, business and education. They see small sats as a way to speed up the process from the moment you have your idea to when you get your data. Then there are companies like Open Cosmos that want to accelerate things even further by taking care of everything from building your satellite to launching it and running the operations, legal affairs, etc. All you have to do is pay up and let the data roll in. Dr. Ross Bergen of the Open University says there are differences in the quality of data and imagery you get from small satellites, but nano or CubeSats have a lot going for them.
One of the real powerful things with CubeSats, which is yet to actually properly take force, is the fact that you're able to use them in constellations. Because they are relatively low cost, you can actually use many of them at the same time and get a temporal coverage of the Earth, whereas one spacecraft only gives you a spatial coverage at one time. You could have a constellation of 20 or 30 CubeSats, which could cover the Earth all the time.
And that's exactly what a company like EarthEye is banking on. Large constellations of low-cost small satellites. It's a cornerstone of a commercial space industry. EarthEye's Jonathan Sumner says Earth observation is moving away from the non-commercial agency-based programs.
It's certainly changing. It doesn't mean that those are irrelevant. So Sentinel and the Copernicus program in many ways it can be credited with creating this opportunity, because they've made Earth observation more widely available, much more accessible. And of course, with Copernicus, it's free. And that's really fed the innovators. The innovators have been out there being able to start to use Earth observation data. But it's medium resolution. And what we're bringing is high spatial resolution, sub 1 meter, and high temporal resolution with the launch of multiple satellites, many satellites covering many more parts of the Earth at different times of day.
Well, I guess that's one way to stand on the shoulder of giants. They were good, real good, but we're better, much better.
We are indeed. Sulfika Abani reporting there.
A language I don't understand. You speak, I listen, I'm your friend. Take my hand.
From small satellites to enormous satellites that let you see everything on Earth with just the click of a button. That's what my next guest is capable of. Dr. Bianca Hirsch is mission manager for the European Space Agency's Sentinel 2 satellite program. I caught up with Bianca before we came on air to find out about the Earth observation mission and what her job really entails. Take a listen. Bianca Hirsch, welcome to Spectrum.
What does your role as Sentinel-2 mission manager involve?
The Sentinel-2 mission management means I take care of the exploitation phase of a satellite, which is the phase during which it delivers data to its users. So it's basically the end-to-end program management for anything that concerns the data acquisition, the dissemination of data to our users, the product's quality, and of course also the reporting on the status of this program to our member states.
And that's what I want to get into. You've mentioned there your satellites and the information that they get. How is that information used for the everyday person or for governments? Could you tell me about that?
Yes. So the satellite is measuring. It's flying around the globe every 90 minutes, and it's constantly measuring and acquiring information on the surface of the Earth. So that information is then downloaded from the satellite to the ground, where it is processed into data products or satellite images. You can imagine this to be something like you would take with your camera, just a little bit more sophisticated, maybe with more spectral information and a higher spatial resolution. And this information can be used to derive information, for example, on the state of your agricultural field or on the state of your forest, on deforestation, or if you talk about the pole regions, on the melting of glaciers, on the melting of sea ice. So there's lots of environmental information that you can take from these data.
Is this satellite imagery that you talk about, is there any way that that can assist developing countries, perhaps with food security?
Definitely. What we do when we measure, as I said, every 5-6 days, we're measuring the complete land cover. So developing countries can also access that information and can, for example, derive the state of their agricultural growth. They can make forecasts on the yield that they could expect at the end of a season. So all this information can be derived from satellite data.
Are we seeing the Earth's surface changing at all in any of the data that you're seeing?
Yes, the Earth's surface is changing a lot. It's not only what is growing on this Earth's surface or what is changing over time, but we see also that the Earth's surface itself is changing. So it might there might be subsidence, so it might be go down, it might go up. We can measure this with a very high precision of in the millimeter range with our satellites. We can see sinking cities, we can see the effect of taking out groundwater. So this surface deformation we can measure.
When you talk of sinking cities, are there any examples that you can give?
Yes, there are a couple of examples. One example that was quite recent was with the Sentinel-1 satellite. We measured the sinking of skyscrapers in the US, and there's one example in San Francisco where there was the Millennium Tower that was basically sinking by 50 millimeters a year. So this is something we could measure with the satellite.
Can your satellites show information which would perhaps predict natural catastrophes?
With the same technique of measuring what the Earth's surface does, if it's rising or if it's going down, we can measure, for example, volcanic activity. So you might be able to forecast if there's increased volcanic activity, which is leading to rising or sinking of the Earth. This might lead to a higher probability that there's going to be a volcanic eruption.
You're one of a few women in space research, and women are often underrepresented in the realms of science in general. What would you say to women wanting to pursue a career in science or even space science?
I would definitely encourage them. I think more women should do this type of job. So mathematics, informatics, all these types of different sciences. I strongly encourage women to take up these opportunities.
Dr. Bianca Hirsch, Mission Manager for the European Space Agency's Sentinel-2 satellite program, joining me there. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Jessie Wingard, on DW. You can keep up to date with all things happening in the science and technology world by following us on Twitter at DW_SciTech or online, dw.com/science. And I'm at Jessie Wingard. There's that mystery sound again. Are you feeling it? Is your skin crawling? We'll find out exactly what it is and what's triggering those sensations in your body. But first, to sounds of a different kind. Scientists around the world are only just beginning to research a new way in which humans react to sound. It's called ASMR, or Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. People who experience ASMR describe feeling a pleasant tingling sensation. Connor Dillon has more on how YouTubers may have stumbled across a strange new form of audio therapy.
It's a pleasant, tingling feeling that you experience when you hear unique, soft voices or hear certain soothing sounds, such as tapping.
This is Maria, the most popular YouTuber in a growing field of sonic science called ASMR. Under the name Gentle Whispering ASMR, Maria's soft, soothing voice is meant to elicit sensations in your body and on your skin. Here, she describes what it's supposed to feel like.
This tingly sensation is euphoric. It starts in the back of your head, travels down through your spine, into your limbs, relaxing you, giving you a feeling of well-being. We believe that everyone has the ability to experience it. It's simply a matter of finding the trigger that speaks to you.
Whispering is just one trigger. Here, another prominent ASMR YouTuber, her name is Fast ASMR, goes through other potential trigger sounds, beginning with a metal bottle. Then some hand lotion. And finally, she flips through the pages of a book. Another kind of ASMR involves role-playing, like mimicking the sounds of a massage or even a doctor's visit. Now, see if you can place this location, which was recorded by a YouTuber who calls herself ASMR Darling. The answer? You're getting a haircut. Okay, so soft whispering, lots of hands action, a bit of role-playing. If at this point you're wondering whether there's as much sexuality as science or pseudoscience happening in these ASMR videos, then you're not alone. The women behind these videos, and most of them are women, tend to be young and attractive. Researchers at Swansea University wondered whether users were consuming these videos for the sexual aspects. But of the nearly 500 people they surveyed, just 5% said the ASMR videos elicited some form of sexual response. The other 95% said they watched the videos for the same reasons everyone else does, to feel the tingles, to help them reduce stress, or to relax. Dr. Craig Richard founded the online ASMR University Response Resource Center to collect and promote further research. To date, only 3 peer-reviewed studies have been conducted. 2 involved surveying people, and here he talks about the only biological study conducted to date.
So they took individuals who did experience ASMR and compared them to a group of people who did not experience ASMR, and they did an MRI study of them. So basically they looked at brain activity. And they showed that those people who experience ASMR have different types of functional connectivity in their brain compared to people who don't experience ASMR.
Dr. Richard feels that this field, which only got a name in 2010, is wide open for further research. He says randomized trials would be a good place to start to figure out what percentage of people experience ASMR. No one has an answer to that. From there, it should move to further biological studies with instruments like measuring heart rates, blood pressure, respiratory rates, and brain activity. These measurements could show a drop in heart rate, in blood pressure, a calming of the breathing rate, or a decrease in brain activity. The next level, he says, would involve examining blood.
So if ASMR is reducing stress the way it's being widely reported to, then you should see a reduction in cortisol levels, which are one of the major chronic stress hormones. And the other type of biological test that would be very interesting are genetic tests. The type of biological chemicals that are probably associated with the experience of ASMR are oxytocin, endorphins, serotonin, dopamine, and GABA. And so genetic tests might show that people who experience ASMR may have certain types of mutations in the genes for these chemicals or the receptors for these chemicals.
Further research, he says, should look at the healthy side effects, like reducing stress, anxiety, or reducing the effects of insomnia. Thereafter, ASMR could be considered a clinical treatment. Patients diagnosed with certain conditions, like chronic pain, could use ASMR as a form of experimental therapy. A therapist would then incorporate ASMR trigger sounds and techniques as a part of that therapy. That may be 10 to 15 years off, he says. Until then, those seeking ASMR therapy will have to continue to self-medicate with YouTube, like with the videos of this ASMR YouTuber from Germany who calls himself Mr. Zeitgeist. Connor Dillon for DW. Uka chaka, uka, uka, uka chaka, uka, uka, uka chaka, uka, uka, uka chaka, uka, uka.
I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me. Girl, you just don't realize what you do to me. When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's all right.
It's time to find out what that mystery sound we've been playing is. Is it annoying you? Well, it is me. What if I play it again? Okay, no, I'm not going to do that. Still no idea? It's the sound of someone eating. And for some people, it triggers something in their brain. While there are people out there who might get a spine-tingling sensation of a good kind when they hear particular noises, like we just heard, some people find sounds like listening to others chew food or the clicking of a pen or wet hands sliding down a window totally unbearable. These trigger sounds can often spark a flight or fight response. With me on the line from the University of Iowa's Department of Neurosurgery is Dr. Phil Gander, who's been looking into changes in brain activity when people experience these trigger sounds. Dr. Gander, welcome to Spectrum. It's long been thought that people who simply cannot stand certain sounds, like listening to others chew food, clicking of pens, etc., were being intolerant. But you've put that theory to bed with your new research. What did you find?
Well, we found actually that something that had been relatively recently described in the literature, something called misophonia, which means a hatred of sound, has some very clear brain correlates. And I guess I should say that this is something that has probably existed forever, but has only very recently been recognized in the medical field and in the research field, and does not appear in any sort of psychiatric or psychological diagnostic manual. So it's completely off the radar, essentially, of the research and medical world.
Let's talk about the trigger sounds, the loud breathing, the eating, the packets rustling. Is it set sounds that trigger people, or is it different sounds for different people?
Yeah, that's a great question. Each person has typically a unique set of sounds. And what's more interesting is that it's often related to a very specific person or group of people. So it's often related to a family member and only one family member. But then unfortunately what happens and what makes it considerably more debilitating is that it can generalize to more people or everyone, such that any time that someone's making breathing sounds will get people with this disorder to have this really severe response.
So let's talk about that response. What's happening in a sufferer's brain when they hear one of the trigger sounds?
Right. Very, very simply, actually, is they experience a very extreme fight or flight response. And this is a response that we've sort of evolved to have to protect us from danger. But clearly this is an inappropriate response to sounds such as eating or a bag of chips being rustled or footsteps even. And so it's completely an over-response to these sounds. And that's what we also found in the brain. So when we compared the brain activity of so-called normal controls and a group of people who self-identified with having misophonia, they exhibited responses that were similar between the groups for normal, innocuous sounds like rain or children playing or something like this. But when they were played sounds that are these so-called trigger sounds, so people eating or breathing or chewing sounds, the normal control group showed not really different responses as compared to the other sounds, but the group with misophonia showed this really enhanced set of responses in key brain regions. And these brain regions included something called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is involved in sort of top-down control and learning, and another brain region called the anterior insula, which is a brain region that's responsible for many things, but one thing that we believe that's particularly relevant here is that it's responsible for processes of internal body monitoring. So perception is a word that we use to talk about our reception of or interaction with the external world, but interoception is a term that's used to refer to people's essentially perception of their inner world. And this brain region is exactly what is doing this type of processing.
Did they exhibit any physical symptoms, or was it purely what you were able to see in the brain?
Everything that we measured was very straightforward. So we got these abnormal responses in the brain. The brain regions that I was just talking about were abnormally interactive with each other. They were connected with each other. So basically they were talking to each other in a way that they don't normally do. And we also measured their sweating response, also called a galvanic skin response. And so they showed an enhanced stress response selectively to these sounds. Also their heart rate went up. So a complete physiological reaction that is akin to what happens when you're faced with being eaten or something like this. You either fight or you get out of there.
Is this a condition that people have from birth, or does it develop later in life?
This happens in sort of teenage years, so pretty early on in life. And some of the people that I've spoken to are talking about how this is something they remember sort of vaguely when they were 10 years old, for example. So it's pretty early on that this happens.
Where to now with your research?
It's early days, I guess, with respect to defining these responses in the body, basically, with respect to clear responses. And there have been some other research papers that have looked at some of changes with respect to what identifies a group with misophonia. So we would want to, of course, replicate our study and perhaps changing some of the parameters with exploring the space of what are the particular types of sounds that are triggering people, even though they select one type of sounds. Does it generalize more than even what they were first aware of? But ultimately, we would really hope that we've paved the way for really identifying something that would be used as a treatment to target certain brain regions.
Dr. Phil Gander from the University of Iowa's Department of Neurosurgery, best of luck with your upcoming research, and thank you for joining me on the program.
Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spectrum. We'll be back next week with another packed edition of the show. In the meantime, you can keep up to date with all things happening in the science and technology world by checking us out on Twitter at @DW_SciTech or online, dw.com/science. I'm Jessie Wingard. On Twitter, you can find me at Jessie Wingard, and I'd love to hear from you. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.